Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome to Hollywood and Levine. I am Ken Levine, your podcast host. Thanks for listening. This is part two of my two-part interview with actor, singer, Broadway performer Chip Zion. And if you missed part one, he talks a lot about being in Into the Woods and working with Stephen Sondheim. If you missed that, after you listen to this episode, go back and check that one out. Chip has been involved in 13 Broadway shows, including long-running hits like Into the Woods and Grand Hotel and Les Miserables. He has also been involved in over 65 television shows, and among them, he was one of the stars of our show, the one with Nancy Travis called Almost Perfect. That was on CBS in 1995 and 1996. In this episode, we talk a little bit about Les Mis, more about his Broadway career, his movie career, in which he was in United 93, and he's like the first guy killed, and he's, for the entire movie, just lying in the corridor. That was a fun job, I'm sure. And working with Mike Nichols. If you ever wondered what it was like to work with Mike Nichols, this is the episode for you. He's also a great storyteller. It's really fun to hear him tell these stories. So here we go. Part two with Chip Zion this week on Hollywood and Levine. So you've been in long-running shows, but you've also gone into existing shows like you were in Les Mis.
Right.
What's it like when you're part of a long-running show and you're inserted into it? How much rehearsal do you get? You know, it's like I'm sure the cast doesn't want to rehearse for 4 days you can be up to speed.
Exactly. Once you've been in a show for a long time and you have to come back to do these what they call put-in rehearsals, it's a huge pain for the regular cast members, who, as I was saying before, are already exhausted because they have to deal with the whole week.
Right.
Les Mis was a really, here's the thing. I loved being in Les Mis. I just loved it. I had made fun of Les Mis, to be honest, because I thought it was like, you know, that I was doing the fancy schmancy, like Sondheim musicals. And Les Mis is one of these English imports that's, you know, it's not what Broadway's supposed to be. And also, why are these people always marching? Always occurred to me. Like, what are they marching? They're marching to, they're standing on the thing with the thing. And, you know, there was marching. And I made fun of that. But I got hired to replace in Les Mis. Les Mis is like a corporation. It's like getting involved in some corporate thing. You know, where you get a costume. Oh yeah, okay, Chip, here's your costume. And you look in the inside panel of the, you know, your jacket that you're wearing as the master of the house, which is the part I was playing. And you look and you see labels for different people that have worn that same costume. You know, and in mine, maybe there were like, by this point, there are like 10 labels. You're thinking,
right.
This is crazy, but they can find parts of people's costumes that fit you, and that's what you're wearing. And in my case, I rehearsed probably 2 weeks, which is actually a luxury. Mm-hmm. And then I got thrown on stage, and I realized in order to get the feel of the turntable, this Les Mis had this massive turntable, that, and that's why they're marching, because the only way that you can remain facing the audience is to keep your legs moving so that you stay in the same place as the turntable is turning. You have to keep stepping slightly sideways to stay on the right place. I had never rehearsed really with a turntable at full speed in full costume with all of the lights working. And so the first night I'm on stage and I'm standing on the turntable and it starts to turn and I start marching. And the next thing I know, I'm looking at utter blackness. I have no idea where I am. And what I had done is I hadn't marched properly. And I was now facing the wings. I was supposed to be facing straight center stage, straight out. And I'm facing the wings. And one of the actors grabbed me. I walked off. I hit the flat that was on this, you know, that one of the actors grabbed me and pulled me back on stage. I walked into the flat. That's the point of the story. And, you know, but it's weird to come into a show that's that well known by the people who play. They've all been in it for years. They all know everything. And it was weird. I mean, you know, one of the terrible mistakes I made is just being thrown in there was that I called Valjean famously. There's a scene where the master of the house throws, is walking through the sewers, robbing bodies of jewelry and stuff. And I rolled over Valjean and I screamed out Javert, and it was Valjean, and all of the cast members, everybody started laughing. I could hear the crew laughing, and when I walked off stage, the stage manager was laughing so hard. He was sitting on the floor, and he had taken off, they all wore headphones, and he had taken off his headphone and thrown it down on the floor. They were just crying. It was just a terrible mistake, and I had no recovery. I think my recovery was like, I mean, and then I think I just left. I just walked off. It was just awful. But Les Mis, I love being in Les Mis, and I would have stayed a long time, but I couldn't. I had another job.
So let's turn to your film and TV work here. Now,
yeah,
you were in a movie called United 93.
Oh, yes, I was. Yeah.
And interesting choreography for that movie. Talk about your role in that movie.
Well, United 93 was about 9/11. It's mm-hmm. about the plane that crashed. United 93 was
headed for the Pentagon.
Headed for the Pentagon and crashed in the countryside in Pennsylvania. And, well, let's see, the audition for that film was they would take a group of people in at a time and they would ask you to improvise what would happen if you were all sitting together on a plane and the plane got hijacked and your lives were in danger. And I turned to an actress that I'm very fond of, Kate Jennings Grant, who happened to be in my little group of maybe six people. And I said, I am not doing this. Okay, I'm not going to do this. Is the idea here that people are supposed to eat popcorn while they're watching this horrifying story about 9/11 and that we know what happened? And I said, this just doesn't really feel like something that should get made. Okay, you shouldn't be eating popcorn watching United 93 crash into the fields of Pennsylvania. And the director was there and he said, so I'll just say go, and you guys just start an improv. You don't know each other. Whatever comes in your mind, that's the audition. So he yells, go, and I jump up and start screaming because I'm an idiot actor. I completely, because I think like, I've got to act. I'm acting. Okay. And what? No, it doesn't matter what I just previously said to Cate Grant. It means I've got to get this job. And I start screaming like, just we can talk about this or something really lame. Let's talk about this. And, you know, and I'm screaming and carrying on. And I get the job, and so did Cate. It's a story that we just laugh about all the time because I completely did exactly the – she just sat there. She got the job. I don't know what I was doing, trying to show off or – I don't know what – but it was horrible, but I got the job. And it turned out to be actually an incredible experience because it was directed by Paul Greengrass, a Brit. We flew to we shot the film in outside of we actually shot the film in Slough, which is where the original The Office is set. You know, that the TV series, the English version,
right? The Ricky Gervais version.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So. And we shot for weeks sitting on a plane we were in a plane, but the plane was on it was on a device that shook it around and moved it. And it was outside of the windows were, sky. You could see, a psych behind, on either side. And so you really felt like you were on a plane, and they recreated the flight pattern of the plane based on, the data they had from flight recorders. So it was a hell of an experience, but I played the first person to be killed, or what they think was the first person to be killed. And I got knifed on the side of my neck, stabbed, and I basically bled out in the aisle of the airplane.
You were in the aisle of the airplane the whole movie, right?
Yes, I was, as people were walking over me and stepping over me, saying, Chip, are you okay? Are you okay? And I also had to pump my own blood. I had a squeeze ball on my one hand that I had to sort of hide behind my body so that the blood would continue to flow. I was basically pumping blood with ketchup, basically pumping ketchup out of a tube that was on my neck. Yeah. And then, I don't know, at some point, because we were all in the trenches together, it got a little goofy, but at some point somebody was screaming, I thought they were screaming, take the Jews, one of the other improv passengers was screaming, take the Jews, take the Jews. And I whispered to Cate Grant, who was attending to me as one of the few nurses on the plane. I said, is she saying, take the Jews, take the Jews? And she said, no, they're saying, take the jewels. We have jewels in the luggage compartment. Take the jewels. I said, and that, then we're laughing. And the camera, they rolled the camera for 20 minutes at a time. The camera went up and down the aisle of the airplane. So you had to kind of stay in character. But we had to unfortunately roll over because we were laughing about take the Jews when they, no, we didn't know if anybody actually said that. But it was actually... The actress was saying, take the jewels.
Well, being in New York, of course, you had to be on Law and Order because every New York actor is on Law and Order. And yes. I see that you've played lawyers, judges, and a homeless guy.
Yeah. did you know Joe Stern, the producer of that show?
No.
Because he ended up in L.A. for quite a while, too. Yeah, everybody in New York is on Law and Order at some point. If you're in the biz, I got lost one day in the sort of the law, the vernacular of lawyer speak. And he's a really good friend of mine, the producer of that show, Joe Stern, from years ago. Basically came up to me and said, you're killing me. I said, Joe, I don't know what's happened. I said, I kept stumbling over some word that all lawyers use, it was easy, but I wish I'd been on it more. I wish I'd been on it as a regular.
Well, they don't have enough Law and Order spinoffs.
No.
Maybe if they have a spinoff.
Yeah, maybe if they think of some other show that could.
Yeah, Law and Order Broadway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you've been in a lot of hits, and you've also been in a few that weren't as successful.
Yes.
You were the voice of Howard the Duck. One of the most notoriously bad films in the history of show business. It was George Lucas.
Yes. I auditioned, I was doing Merrily We Roll Along in La Jolla, and the casting director from Universal came backstage and she said to me, really didn't care for Merrily We Roll Along, but you sound like a duck. And she said, we're casting a show called Howard the Duck, and you sound like you could be a duck. Would you be willing to come in an audition? And I was, of course, livid that she was saying that my voice sounded somehow to her like a duck.
Right.
So I called my agent. I said, well, there's some movie, Howard the Duck. He said, you're kidding me. The casting director of Howard the Duck came back. And so I started auditioning for Howard the Duck. And, you know what happened eventually was that I auditioned maybe six times. At some point, I had gone back to New York. I had to fly to Lucas, what I call Lucas Land, out in San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
And
Industrial Light and Magic.
But I don't get the job. So they hire Robin Williams. But the trick with Howard the Duck was that you had to match the looping to put the voice in, had to actually match the duck bill, the rhythm of the duck bill. And they'd had this English guy who did that on the set. But for some reason, they wanted to change that. So anyway, Robin Williams is doing it for 3 days. This is what I heard or what I knew. And after about the third day, he said, this is ridiculous. He said, first of all, that rhythm of the duck, I can't match that. He said, there's no point. It's bad. They're bad line readings. So he dropped out, and I got a call on Labor Day or Memorial Day? What's the first one? Memorial Day?
Memorial Day's in May.
I got a call on Memorial Day saying, Chip, you got to get on a plane right now. Your wife can send you clothes later. You got a reservation. You got to get on a plane. You are Howard the Duck. And that's why I got out to L.A. And I think this can't, So I had seen little snippets of the film. And I said, this can't work. It looks like a little guy in a duck bag. It looks like a small person and basically a duck bag. Uh-huh. And we've already had E.T. or, this is like, no. And then you loop a film in 12-minute reels. And so I finally saw an entire 12-minute reel and I start looping it. And I suddenly think, this is the greatest movie ever made. And I am Howard the Duck. And the money, of course, was just astronomical. I mean, it was just unimaginable. And so I spent maybe, I don't know what it was, almost 2 months looping the film. And I'm loving my new, the fact that.
And you figure, boy, this is going to be a franchise.
Yeah, no,
there's going to be series.
Howard the Duck was supposed to be the voice. He was going to be one of the hosts on Entertainment Tonight. And I was going to be a host on Entertainment Tonight. I was going to be an AT&T spokesman, and plus all of the other, the little games and toys that they put out.
Sure,
I had a percentage of that, and so it was like. And there were supposed to be three Howard the Duck movies. There were supposed to be two sequels after the first one. And I'm thinking, like, man,
you're set.
I'm set. I can buy anything. I can get country houses. It's the same thing I said before. I said to my wife, let's not just buy one car. Let's buy two cars, so we finished looping the film and they put me in this big stretch limousine to fly back to New York. And I rolled down the window and Willard Hike, Gloria Katz. I love them both. They wrote and directed the film.
Right. They also wrote American Graffiti.
Exactly.
And they're lovely people.
Yeah, they were just, I love them. Mm-hmm. And I rolled the window down and they said, Chip, you are Howard the Duck. And I rolled the window back up and I thought, like, I won the lottery. This is just phenomenal. Then I don't hear anything for several months. And then I don't get invited to any like opening thing anywhere. Usually you would have like a big opening night party somewhere. No invitation. I'm checking with my agent, like, what's happening? He said, yeah, I think they're not having that opening night event. So it's opening at a theater next to me on 83rd Street and Broadway, where I live right around there. And I go to the first, I've never seen it. I go to the first screening, or the first showing of the opening of Howard the Duck at the movie theater that was nearest to me. And there were like 8 people there. And they were basically, what they were, is like 8 mothers with little baby children, like toddlers. And like, because they thought, well, this is going to be a cute film, like a Disney film about a duck. It's a terrifying movie for, you know, you have to be a certain age to be able to deal with this film. And I was running up and down the aisle saying, like, you know, this, no, this is not like a, there's some really scary stuff in this film and you shouldn't be here. And they thought I was like a, you know, some strange guy lurking in the movie theater. And then it opened and the reviews just couldn't have been worse. They said that years later, what was the film the Dustin Hoffman and
Ishtar.
Later, when Ishtar opened, they said Ishtar is Arabic for Howard the Duck. Okay. I mean, it was just the biggest bomb at the time. Howard the Duck was the biggest movie flop ever. And, you know, I was friendly with a comedy writer who was out in L.A. trying to sell scripts, and old friend of mine. And he said that Frank Price was the head of Universal, I think, in that era.
Right.
And Frank Price, outside of the window of his office on the whatever floor he was on of that big gray building there at the universe, looks out and he looks at the billboard. It's a huge billboard of Howard the Duck. And my friend called me after that meeting and he said, you know, I saw the head of Universal shudder with terror as he looked out his window at that poster. And he turned to me and he said, they're going to fire me. They're going to fire me. And that is what happened.
Wow.
Yeah. So Howard the Duck. Yeah.
And on Broadway, yeah, you worked with Mike Nichols, but in A Country Girl. You know, yeah, if you read the Mark Harris biography of Mike Nichols, he talks about how that's one that didn't fare very well.
You know, I had a very bad experience with Mike Nichols. Very complicated experience. The Country Girl starred Frances McDormand and Morgan Freeman, Peter Gallagher. And, you know, I met Mike Nichols actually in a men's room originally. We were standing at the urinals in a men's room. And he happened to be next to me. And I thought, like, you know what? This may be the only chance that I ever get to talk to Mike Nichols. And I was rehearsing a show. We were in a big rehearsal studio, and he was rehearsing a different show at the time. And I said to him, I'm really struggling with my show, which, by the way, at the time was called The Suicide. It's a Broadway show, but starring Derek Jacobi, which was very cool. And I said, you know, I just don't know what I'm doing. He said, so I said, do you have any advice for me? And Mike Nichols, standing next to me, said, it's very simple. You talk fast, you talk slow. You talk loud, you talk soft, mix them all up, and you'll have a hell of a performance. That was Mike Nichols' advice to me. And I love this guy. That is right. Funny, and that is brilliant. You know, jump ahead. I auditioned for him for The Country Girl, and it's a great audition. He pulls his chair up. I'm sitting there in the rehearsal. I'm nervous, but he was so nice, and he pulls his chair up to within about 3 feet of where I'm sitting, and it becomes very intimate and personable, and I read for the part, and he goes like, yeah, well, you've been there, you've lived this, it's great, yeah, I'm a big fan of yours, love Into the Woods, you know, he was just, it just couldn't have gone better. And I thought, like, my God, I might actually, maybe I'm going to get this, and I got it, you know, finally the next day I get a call. Chip, you got it. It's amazing. So I'm thrilled. And we start rehearsals, and he hates every single thing I'm doing. He's yelling at me. He said, like, what are you doing? You know, why do you like starting a scene? I don't want to see anybody start a scene. Like, you know, it should just kind of happen. Let it just happen. You're like, what are you doing? Why are you yelling? I said, well, it said in the script I was supposed to yell. I'm yelling because the other character asks, why are you yelling? So if I'm not yelling, well, how does the other characters, I'm trying to help out my fellow actor here, you know? And you know, it just was just, we sat at the table for weeks. I mean, like it seemed forever. And he also told Morgan Freeman and Frances McDormand not to learn their lines. He was one of these directors who doesn't want you to know anything so that you don't come in with preconceived ideas. Problem with that is if the play has a lot of words in it, nobody's ever going to know them, you know, and that's what happened. I don't want to mention names, but some two very famous actors in the show who hadn't often been on Broadway did not know their lines. And when we started previewing, there was a prompter in the front row. But what can I talk about publicly?
They mention in the book that he could be a giant asshole at times.
Yeah. Well, I'm reading the book.
And I mean, he admitted it himself. He said I regret the way I handled this or that.
Yeah. Well, what happened was, is that at some point we get to a big tech dress rehearsal. And, you know, it just wasn't going well for you. I thought like I was probably going to get fired. And at some point we have a run through and one of the leads, I won't mention her name, Frances McDormand, said to me, she said, you know, Mike wants me to laugh after I say this line, but I don't want to feel obligated to laugh. So if you could do me a huge favor, I had the next line. Please come in with your line and don't wait for me to laugh. So we were running through the show in front of all of the designers and every, you know, the set designer, the costume design.
Right, lighting and all that.
Lighting, everybody's there. The room is packed with people. And Frances McDormand, I don't want to mention the name, says a line. And it's the line where there's supposed to be a laugh, that she's supposed to laugh at herself. I jump on the line and I don't allow her to laugh at herself because she asked me to do her a favor. And the next thing I know, in front of all these people, and Mike Nichols was there with his daughter, just starts screaming and saying like, what the hell are we supposed to do? Are we supposed to go back now and start at the beginning of the entire show, Chip? Do you even listen to the other actors on the stage? Did you hear one word that she was saying? Do you listen?
Wow.
It's stomping around, standing and pacing. And then he left the room and then he came back. He said, I don't even know what to do. Maybe we have to cancel this run through and all everybody's sitting there. And like, you know, I think I took at least three Xanax at that point. And like, you know, I don't know what to do. And I'm looking at Frances. I'm not going to mention her name. You know, could you like speak up here? I'm trying to help you, you know, and we started again. And we left that day and I called that night. I called the stage manager and I said, am I still in this show? What have you heard anything? And he said, Chip, I haven't heard anything. And he said, I feel exactly like you feel. He said, I don't know if I'm still in this show. And I said, well, call me if you get notified that I'm no longer supposed to show up tomorrow at 10 o'clock.
Right.
The next thing my phone rang and it was Mike Nichols. The problem is that he was in his car and the phone kept cutting out. And I didn't know if I was being fired or if he was saying something. I couldn't hear his message. So I called the stage manager back and I said, I just got a phone call from Mike, but I can't hear it. He said, well, I think you should show up tomorrow, but you know, I mean, if I find out anything later, I'll call you. And I walked in the next day and Mike came up to me and he said, you know, I shouldn't have done that. He said, for some reason, I think of you like I think of Shelley Berman. And I said, what about me reminds you of Shelley Berman? He said, yeah, I don't. He said, I think I'm wrong. I think I was wrong and I shouldn't have done it. And from that point on, he could not have been nicer. He was absolutely charming and witty and fun to be with. We went out for dinner, but it was a very, and he never gave me after that. Every night when we'd have notes about the show, he would say, "Chip, amazing stuff, beautiful." And he would move on, and so it was this very strange experience. But I saw him be, and then he was rather nasty to some of the other actors in the show. And I'm not, it just was, I can't even go there, but it was, he was strange. He was strange, but it's strange because it's like, he's so obviously smarter than anybody and funnier than anybody, but he was capable of being very mean. So that's my take on it.
No, I know a lot of people. And he acknowledges that. We're not speaking out of school here.
I'm based, by the way, I'm reading the book and I'm not up to, that much.
You didn't go to that first?
I didn't go to it first. I've actually had the famous actor Richard Kind.
Mm-hmm.
We all know Richard Kind.
Sure,
Richard
love
came,
the guy.
Richard came up to me the other day, and Dwayne, we're pals, and he came up to me and Dwayne Reed the other day, and he said, "You got nothing to worry about." He said in the Mike Nichols book, he never mentions you. And I thought, wait a minute, is that good or bad? I mean, it would have been nice to be mentioned in this book, but I hope he would have been, He said, "No, nothing to worry about. Nothing to worry about. You're not in it at all." But he does talk about the show that you were in. So,
okay, before we go, I want to jump back to auditions and what that's like. Because, like I said to you off the air, mm-hmm. You're a braver man than me, Gunga Din, to put yourself through that and all of the rejection. And what's it like to audition for a part? This was what would drive me out of my mind. To audition for a part, you don't get it, and then you see who they did hire for the commercial or whatever, and you're going, "Really? Really? I lost out to that guy?"
No, it happens all the time. Auditioning, there are times, I think I've always been better when, for whatever reason, I didn't have to audition. Because it's, there are people who, basically, one of the things that you're taught is that you're supposed to audition for yourself, that you want to see how you feel playing this role. And that's the best you can do. The gift that you're giving the casting people is the choices that you're making. And if they don't buy it, then that's the way it is.
Right.
But you're one of the things that teachers always say is that you have to think of how you feel and that you're being generous in offering yourself up for this job. And it's in a way, it's a gift. That's hard for me. I have felt okay at times and at other times, like for some of the Broadway auditions, I've actually, I have a sense that, I feel I can predict what's going to happen or that that I'll be in the mix or at least in the running. And it's fun. Sometimes I see, you're auditioning for people that quite well. And that's either awkward or, whatever. I have found that whatever my mood is on any given day can dictate what that audition experience is like. Hmm. One time I auditioned for a TV show for a pilot out in L.A. I can't remember which one it was, but I was playing a guy who was having a panic attack. The audition was a scene where the actor's having a panic attack.
Well, that must have been easy.
No. So what happened is I decided this is going to be easy, right? And I started to have a panic attack, which I should be pretty good at,
right?
Or which I just assume I'm going to be excellent at that panic attack. And I went in and I did it. And I thought I was really good. I walked out. I thought this is for a TV show. I said, I've got a shot at this because I think that really went well. And then I waited. The next person to go in the room was somebody that I knew, and I wanted to chat with him a little more. So I waited for him to finish. And when he auditioned, he said, did they have a tape line put down there on the floor for your audition? I said, no, I don't know what you mean. He said, because they were saying that, like, they had to put some tape down to indicate where the actor should, how far away from the producers and the, you know, the people you're auditioning for, that they wanted the actors to stay a little further back from the producers and the writers, because the actor who'd been in her before got too close to them. Well, that was me. I had, they taped the floor after I left to indicate to the actors, please do not cross this line and get too close to us. We don't need you that close. And that was because of my audition. After all, you know, all these years of auditioning, I was using them as people in the scene, and they hated it, you know? So, you know, the experiences are weird. When I went on camera for Almost Perfect, I love the New York cast. Bonnie Finnegan cast that in New York, this casting director that I just love. And, you know, I just loved doing that for her. I always felt I was good at CBS and that I was terrible at ABC. I have no idea why. I thought the CBS rooms were funny. I could be funny, but the ABC rooms were not funny, you know? And finally, at one point at ABC, I said to myself, when they were giving me a ton of notes about an on-camera audition, I said, you know what? Let me lose this part by myself. Okay. Let me lose this all by myself. There's other actors that are going to come in here and do what you're saying, but like, I don't know. I'm not clear on what you're saying. Let me just do my thing. And if you hate it, I won't get the job, you know, but the way I always put it is let me lose it by myself. And that was very insulting to the casting people, by the way, because they want to feel, which wasn't good. I don't think I ever got back.
They want to feel that they cost you the job.
Yeah. They want to feel that they either got you the job or that they're helping you. You don't want to offend the casting people because they want to feel like they're involved in your audition,
right?
Which is their job,
right?
But I never got back in that room at ABC, as I recall. So, you know, I learned, I don't memorize my lines for auditions. Although now the style is a lot, most people are memorizing with their lines.
I mean, I hate when the actors memorize the lines.
Yeah, I mean, there's really not enough time, so you kind of screw up because you're so worried about coming in with lines memorized.
Exactly.
It doesn't
just
help
read
you.
The line. I understand. Yeah. You're reading it off a script,
right?
I understand. Yeah.
Yeah, you may have to look down,
right?
First, whatever.
Exactly.
You know, try to stay alive, but you may have to look down.
So oftentimes they'll botch up the script. And yeah. They'll screw up the jokes.
Right. They'll
ruin
the jokes.
I want to hear it. This is what I want to hear.
Yeah. And that's a whole nother issue because you also don't know sometimes going into a room, which writers, you know, don't mind if you like, you know, make stuff up. But other people are, you know, need to know that you can accomplish their writing, and they're not a game for you to like just go off on your own.
Right. It's not a blueprint.
Right. It's an actual script. So that gets complicated. And you know, honestly, I, you know, you get a little confidence as you go along, but I always felt that my mood is very dependent on who's standing in front of me, either the camera or sitting in a chair looking at me. You know, it's like a Rorschach test for crazy people. An audition is a Rorschach test for the actors, the insane people who are willing to humiliate themselves. And sometimes the Rorschach test, I can interpret it, and sometimes I miss. I guess that's kind of how I feel about it.
Well, Chip, this has been great. I could talk to you forever. Thank you so much for the great work that you did on Almost Perfect. And
I miss
your character. I write that character in so many different plays and movies and shows. It's like I'm always hearing you in my head. It's my favorite character to write. It's you.
You know, and the truth is, I've never had anything more fun, and I can't believe we didn't get many more years out of it.
I agree. Well, let's move this.
It's one of the top. I just think, like, darn it, how did that happen?
Yeah. That go on YouTube, by the way, and look up Almost Perfect, Nancy Travis. We have a bunch of episodes up there. So
if you want to watch
Almost Perfect, you can do it.
I forget. Like what we did. I mean, there's an episode where I'm like crawling around on the floor on my knees yelling at Matt Lesher and having a fit. And
yeah, that's called Sweets for the Sweet. If you want to look that up. Yeah.
There's stuff. And like, I should also just say that you asked me at one point during the run of the show, like, who would I like to meet or act with? And I said, Marie Osmond.
Uh-huh.
My choice was Marie Osmond.
Right. And we got her.
I always wanted to be Donna, I wanted to be on this show and you guys got her and I got to, it was so much fun that, you know, it just, we were having the time of our lives. Network executives, you know, what can you do?
Exactly. Thanks, Chip.
Love you, man. It was great. Great to see you in person. Great to talk to you.
And there you go. My two-part interview with actor, singer, Howard the Duck voice, Chip Zion. As always, thanks to Adam and Susie Meister, Butler, to Howard Hoffman, John Wolford, Bruce, and Jason Miller. I am available via email if you wish to reach out and talk to me. HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com is my email address. That again is HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. You can follow me on Twitter. I can't believe you're not following me already. @KenLevine. Also on Instagram, Hollywood and Levine. And our thanks again to Chip Zion. Back with another interesting interview next week. Thanks so much for listening. And get vaccinated when you can. Bye.
Hollywood and Levine.